America's relationship with cotton was not unlike Faust's relationship with the devil. It generated spectacular benefits, but at the cost of a soul. Cotton may be just a crop, but it has also been a determinative factor in our political, economic, and social history, particularly with regard to race, and its legitimacy remains apparent today. Gene Dattle's book, Cotton and Race in the Making of America, examines the power and impact of this phenomenon. It's published by Ivan RD, and I'm very pleased that it brings Gene Dattle to our show today. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Why do you start your book with the Constitutional Convention? Didn't that take place before cotton took on real importance in the United States? I'm going to say the United States, but in what were to be the United States?
Yes, and that's the reason why I started there, for two reasons. One, because there was no cotton grown in the United States, and two, because slavery...
There was none at all?
Virtually none. And secondly, because that was the period when slavery was enshrined in the Constitution, so the country had a choice, a nation with slavery or no nation without slavery, and the founders thought that slavery would become extinct.
But then cotton changed all of that? That was after the United States were formed?
Absolutely. What happened was that there was this simultaneous events, one of which was the Industrial Revolution, which occurred in England with technology, which created mass production for textiles. And the second was Eli Whitney's invention of the cotton gin, which made cotton production much more efficient. So in a way, the founding fathers were blindsided by cotton.
But the cotton gin made it easier. I would have thought that would have eliminated the argument for having slaves.
There were still two bottlenecks in production of cotton, one of which was picking the cotton and the other was weeding the cotton. So it was an enormously labor-intensive industry.
And was this only something in the South?
Yes, because of geography, weather, et cetera. The American South proved to be a perfect place to do that, and also American ingenuity.
But since cotton wasn't the big factor, we associate cotton with slavery, then why was it so important for some states to make sure that slavery was allowed in the Constitution?
In the Constitution, South Carolina, Georgia, and North Carolina still had staple crops, and they wanted to protect their slave interest. Abolition of slavery could not even be mentioned at the Constitutional Convention. It would have ended the Constitutional Convention then and there. So the compromise was brokered at that point.
Mm-hmm. In other words, it was a choice between a nation with slavery or no nation?
Absolutely.
Were all the states that were concerned southern states, or was slavery also something that was defended by some of the northern states?
Slavery was not defended by the northern states, but they recognized the priority. And the priority for Alexander Hamilton and all of these anti-slavery advocates, including Benjamin Franklin, was to create a nation. It was not slavery. And what we must look at, even at the beginning at this point, was not only what these people thought about slavery, but what they thought about black people.
Well, we'll get into that in a moment, but compromises are always made when you're trying to do something difficult. We just saw that in this health care reform legislation where abortion became a sticking point. Would slavery have been the equivalent? Or you say it was hardly discussed during the Constitutional Convention.
The reason why it wasn't discussed was because, as I said, the southern states would not have joined the Union. And secondly, there was no economic justification at the convention for slavery. They thought it would wither and die. At this point in our history, slavery was a moral anachronism. And they thought it was an economic anachronism, but it wasn't.
Well, it had been largely eliminated in the North, but not completely.
Eliminated is probably not the correct way to look at it, it wasn't profitable in the North. The North is interesting in the sense that what we'll have to look at is how free blacks were treated in the North, because that would become the perfect predictor of what would happen after emancipation in America.
So what was the situation of free blacks in the United States at that time? Were they given the same rights as white citizens?
No. And you can look at state by state in terms of the colonial states, New York in particular, and Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were all denied the right to vote. These were with small populations, 1.5%. Connecticut is most interesting because it created a survey in 1800 to ask, were free blacks different from those enslaved? The report came back so damning, it indicated they are victims of sloth, poverty, ignorance, and vice. Within 2 years, 1.5% of Connecticut's free black population was disenfranchised, which it was throughout the 19th century until the 15th Amendment, which Connecticut voted against. Also, colonization societies started immediately after this.
Well, poor whites were also denied the right to vote. Didn't you have to be a property owner? Well, at least at the very beginning when the United States was formed?
At the very beginning, but this began to change consistently. And in New York State, as we know, the white property qualification was eliminated, but it was maintained at a higher level for black people.
Well, we mentioned that Washington and Jefferson, both Virginians, were slave owners, but many of the other important founding fathers, influential ones, were not: Franklin, Hamilton, Adams. But did they share this attitude about black people?
Let's look at Franklin. Franklin owned a slave for 30 years. He was the lobbyist for the state of Georgia in trying to get their slave code passed in Georgia. After the Constitution in 1789, he said that free blacks should be supervised by a branch of a national police force, and that young free blacks should be educated in terms of morality, and they should be trained for the simplest of jobs.
Now, what would have led him to that? Did he have much contact with black people?
Not much, but the brute racial fear, something that was pervasive in the North. Franklin always thought that and was concerned with a large free black population as darkening the beautiful white and red race.
Now, he spent a lot of time in Europe, and there were different attitudes about blacks in Europe. In fact, slavery was abolished in England. I'm not sure what was going on in France, but I don't think there was any slavery in France, was there?
Again, we have to distinguish between attitudes towards slavery and attitudes towards black people. Europeans were certainly not at the Constitution had abolished slavery. But after emancipation, both in England and France, the interest in black people waned considerably, so that there was essentially the same attitude towards blacks in Europe that there was in the United States.
Were there any abolitionists in the Constitutional Convention?
Abolitionists, there were anti-slavery.
Was there such a thing as an abolitionist in 1787?
There were anti-slavery people, and there were abolitionist societies, but they were secondary to this primary objective, an economic objective, a political objective of creating the United States. You either had a United States or you didn't have a United States. What was interesting in terms of abolitionists is to follow their attitudes towards black throughout the beginning of the 19th century.
My guest is Gene Dattel, D-A-T-T-E-L, who grew up in the cotton country of Mississippi Delta. He's written a book called Cotton and Race in the Making of America, The Human Costs of Economic Power, published by Ivan R.D. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, at the time of the Constitutional Convention, you point out little or no cotton was being grown here. Then Eli Whitney develops the cotton gin, and suddenly we see it grown, at least in certain states. Did it require a lot of land?
Yes. Cotton moved with a vengeance across the southwest part of the U.S., western Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi. You went from no production to 4 million bales. You went from
the climate is important in this case.
Climate and soil and rainfall and American ingenuity in terms of devising a cotton seed that was suitable for the American South.
And who was buying all this cotton? The British weren't buying it, even though they dominated the textile industry.
The British were buying this cotton. 90% of all cotton from Britain came from the American South. Britain was extremely vulnerable. And of the 22 million people in Great Britain, 4 to 5 million were directly or indirectly dependent on the cotton textile industry. Enormously vulnerable.
Were they concerned about their dependence on American cotton, considering the fact that there was a strong anti-slavery movement in England?
They were extremely concerned about it. It was prevalent in all of the journals and writings in Great Britain, but they couldn't do anything about it. They could not wean themselves away from the dependency on American cotton.
In the early 19th century, cotton became the growth industry in the United States. How did that affect the original 13 colonies?
Well, it knitted them together. First of all, the trade with the West created a market for Western foodstuffs. Secondly, cotton propelled New York City to commercial and financial prominence.
And that's why New York actually kind of was supported the South at the beginning of the Civil War?
Yes. 35 to 40% of all cotton revenues ended up in New York City. New York controlled, as is obvious, the financing and trading of cotton, plus they sold goods to the South.
You say that Alexander Hamilton, who was opposed to slavery, inadvertently facilitated its expansion.
Yes, it's one of those ironies of American history where you had the adversaries, Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson was able to acquire the Louisiana Purchase because America had a credit system, the credit system being devised by his arch theoretical philosophical enemy, Hamilton. So Jefferson used Hamilton's system to purchase Louisiana. America was credit worthy, could issue $15.5 million worth of bonds.
Were people aware of the fact that by doing this, we were, if anything, increasing the use of slavery, the use of slaves? We were going to be dependent more and more on them?
At this point, there was a recognition of that in 1803. It was still before this economic tornado of cotton had become widely known.
You've also implicated cotton in the harsh treatment of Native Americans. In what way?
Oh, in the sense, well, there was land involved, land on which the Native Americans occupied, but that land was fertile cotton land, so they were eliminated, forced into reservations.
We often talk about the entrepreneurial spirit of Americans. Was that evident in the story of cotton?
Yes, the financial aspects were enormously evident in terms of cotton. It was very, very sophisticated in terms of trading and finance, which was layered on top of a primitive, oppressed labor force.
There's also a lot of land speculation making a lot of people rich, wasn't there?
Yes, and a lot of those speculators came from Boston and New York. But again, we have to be careful in terms of making people rich. This was a boom and bust economy, which totally fluctuated completely on the price of cotton. The price of a slave was totally mathematically related to the price of cotton, not tobacco, not anything else. Cotton and only cotton.
Over time, didn't slavery get rationalized as a positive good where it had just been seen as a necessary evil?
Yes, this occurred coincidentally with the land boom of the 1830s. And there's one quote by someone from Mississippi named Sergeant Prentice, who in 1831 said that slavery was a necessary evil. 5 years later, the same man said it was a positive good. So at this point, you had to rationalize the system. It was not a social system. It was an economic system.
And was slavery pretty much only involved in the growth of and picking of cotton? Because you claim that many other business ventures, which were not run on slavery, depended on the production of cotton.
What happened was slavery only spread where you could grow cotton, and the number of slaves increased from the time of the Constitution, 700,000 to 4 million on the eve of the Civil War. 70% of those people were involved with cotton production.
Well, for example, the railroads didn't employ slave labor, and the cotton mills didn't employ slave labor, but they had a vested interest in protecting the cotton industry.
Yes, actually, there was an attempt to use slave labor in terms of railroads, et cetera. It was generally unsuccessful.
Why was that?
Because there were a number of reasons, one of which was that it wasn't profitable vis-a-vis cotton. Every time the price of cotton went up, you lost your slave labor to producing cotton.
My guess is Gene Dattel. His book, Cotton and Race and the Making of America, The Human Costs of Economic Power, published by Ivan R.D. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Gene Dattel, who's written a book called Cotton and Race and the Making of America, The Human Costs of Economic Power, published by Ivan R.D. Do you think that without cotton, slavery was in fact headed for extinction?
Yes. You needed something that had a gold rush mentality to prolong slavery, and that's exactly what cotton was.
So why did we have all those things like the Missouri Compromise, which allowed slavery to be practiced in states where it was less likely that cotton would be grown?
These were political issues in the sense that the South didn't want to be isolated in terms of the number of senators, et cetera.
We often refer back to Alexis de Tocqueville as the person who seemed to know more about us than we knew about ourselves. What did he notice and comment on about race in America?
He noticed that the prejudice, as he put it, in the North was much more severe than in the South, and he was concerned about violent racial conflicts within America.
So he thought the North was worse because even though some of the blacks were free, they were living lives, seriously difficult lives?
Yes. I mean, he could see that. It was very apparent in the North that whites hated black people. The bigotry was extraordinary. Once you move from the colonial states to Ohio, Illinois, and Indiana, you're talking about exclusion laws. You're not talking about racial prejudice, but exclusion laws. By 1813, Illinois wanted to force every free black and mulatto out, or 39 lashes would be administered.
Interestingly, that's the state of Lincoln.
That's the state of Lincoln.
There were mortality rates of blacks and whites differed extraordinarily in a northern city like Philadelphia.
Yes, part of that was the urban phenomena of a shorter life expectancy in an urban setting. The second was that it was necessary for the slave owners to keep their slaves alive because they were an investment.
Mm-hmm.
Slaves were not even used for dangerous work like working in a levee where there was malarial issues. The expendable class was the Irish. If an Irish person died on a levee, you threw him in a ditch. If a slave died, you had to compensate the owner. It was a horrific form of workman's compensation.
I've never understood exactly why the South seceded when Lincoln was elected, because he never said it was his goal to abolish slavery. Was he threatening the cotton industry?
I think it was a feeling on the part of the South that where they were a nation, and the only reason that they felt they could be a nation, the only reason the world took them seriously, and the only reason the South took itself seriously was because of cotton. So in essence, slave-produced cotton caused the Civil War. It was that confidence that melded into arrogance that led the Confederacy into this war.
And you say that almost as soon as Fort Sumter was fired upon, both sides employed Cotton strategies.
Yes, the Southern strategy was an embargo, which was to prevent England from getting cotton, therefore fomenting a social revolution in England, forcing England to become an ally of the American South. Lincoln, of course, was very aware of cotton's power in the sense of being used to purchase arms, so a blockade was instituted. So there was this odd juxtaposition by adversaries of policy.
And the English did kind of support the South during the Civil War, didn't they?
Massively. The English supplied much of the arms for the South because of the cotton barter, and also because England wanted America dismembered, and England's major fear was that the American North would invade Canada.
Did cotton finance the war in the South?
Ultimately, the South realized its embargo wasn't going to work, and it wasn't going to work because England had a stockpile of 1,200,000 bales, so the cotton famine, as it was called, did not begin until the North had repelled the South at Antietam.
But then the North started capturing more and more land where cotton was grown. Did they continue to grow cotton and engage in the cotton trade?
What happened was the price of cotton moved from 10 cents a pound to $2 a pound, such that you didn't need much cotton to make a lot of money. So even with a small amount of cotton, you could barter for armaments. Not only that, but in the Western Front, you essentially had virtually the entire Union Army corrupted in terms of smuggling cotton.
Well, the South had ordered the burning of all cotton in captured areas, so they were actually cutting down on the amount of cotton that was available.
But a lot of cotton was hidden in the South. Such that there were still huge amounts that could be smuggled by Union forces and Confederate forces.
Do you think the South overestimated the value of King Cotton ultimately for its cause?
I think that it was a flawed strategy. Had the South, and this is something that Jefferson Davis realized after the war, and other people realized after the war, had the South shipped as much cotton as it could to England and France and borrowed against it, then they would have been a much more effective fighting force.
My guest is Gene Dattle, D-A-T-T-E-L. His book, Cotton and Race in the Making of America, The Human Costs of Economic Power, published by Ivan R.D. I would assume that there were people in the North who were concerned about the end of slavery because suddenly we'd have an awful lot of people flooding the job market.
Yes, and this was the embryonic stage of what I call a containment policy. When slaves ended up behind Union lines, the North did not know what to do with them, so they gave them this name, contraband. And the contraband were essentially going to be shipped to Boston. John Andrew, the hero of the movie Glory, said, no, we don't want them. They'll end up as paupers. 2 years later, in 1864, he asked Lincoln to send them up there. Lincoln sarcastically replied, you want them to stay there. What Lincoln knew that John Andrew wanted was a recruitment of these contraband to fill draft quotas. And New York City knows what draft quotas meant. It meant a race riot.
So what was happening in the North? Did attitudes about blacks change at all? Or now were they seen as threats, or were they still seen as inferior?
There was no massive conversion to racial tolerance in the North. The North, as usual, wanted blacks contained in the South. This was supposedly ensured by giving them rights. Hopefully they would stay there. And immediately before the end of the war, the New York Times, February 1865, we must get cotton back into production. That means black labor and white brains.
Were they encouraging blacks to actually own the cotton farms or just be paid wages to work the same kinds of jobs they had when they were slaves?
There were a few isolated incidents of attempting to have black people own land. This is the famous 40 acres and a mule concept, which was not exactly explicit, Lincoln never supported 40 acres and a mule. Mainly, they wanted cotton in production. There was a horde of white northern, particular soldiers who came to the South at the end of the war to farm cotton. Among those, Harriet Beecher Stowe financed her son. She was going to move down and become a cotton farmer.
And they were hoping to make a profit from it? Well, now cotton was much more expensive than it had been when slaves were producing it.
Yes, they were all intrigued by the price of cotton, typical commodity issue. At the end of the war, cotton was 40 cents a pound, which again created this gold rush by northerners who went south and tried to farm land and revolutionize the labor system. They all lost money and went back north.
Could cotton farming have been more mechanized, eliminated the need for all of this intense labor?
It was the most complicated form of agricultural production. Between 1850 and the 1920s, there were 750 different patents on the mechanical cotton picker. None of them worked. And even when the very sophisticated northern implement makers like John Deere tried, they failed until the 1930s.
Why do you say that the plantation and the black sharecropper are the most compelling part of the cotton and race story?
Because that's what happened to the social structure and the racial structure after the Civil War.
The sharecropping system just replaced slavery.
Exactly. What happened was that African Americans, freed slaves, were the first to ask for some form of profit-sharing arrangement. Cotton is very difficult to finance. You don't know how much you're going to plant. You don't know what the insect situation is. You don't know what the weather is. You don't know what the price is. So who's going to finance that?
We have just recently seen settlement of cases where the federal government has denied black farmers help in financing their efforts over the years. What was the situation then? Were black farmers able to raise any capital?
No. And the financing infrastructure was what was missing in this whole picture. And there was no way during the 19th century that you were going to get a financing for black sharecroppers.
So what happened finally with cotton? We don't grow as much cotton in this country, but we still grow a fair amount, don't we?
Well, what happened after the Civil War was essentially cotton production boomed again, such that we had 75% to 80% of the export market.
Uh-huh.
That all ended, and King Cotton's reign ended in 1929-1930, and cotton became a permanent ward of the federal government.
And now a lot of the cotton we get is imported from other countries.
We don't import cotton. We're cotton exporters still because we have no textile industry here. So the major producers are China and Pakistan and India and Brazil. The first three that I mentioned have very, very active subsidies.
You faulted the founding fathers and various government figures over time for putting economic considerations first and planning to deal with moral values later. But didn't you work for 20 years for the capital markets at Salomon Brothers and Morgan Stanley and before you became a scholar?
Yes.
Is there a little bit of a mea culpa here?
Not really. What I really tried to do with the book is show the significance of economics and financial history. And one of the purposes of this book is to redirect the way we teach history to include economic and financial history. In this case, the vehicle was cotton.
We have a comment sent in by Sue from Montclair. She asks, isn't it true that the Lancashire mill workers refused to handle southern cotton during the Civil War, even though it was directly against their own interests?
They never refused to handle southern cotton. One of the differences between sugar and cotton was that you could boycott sugar. You can't boycott cotton.
Not at least until synthetics were developed. But even for now, for many of us, cotton remains king, right? And that. So where is most of the cotton in the world coming from now?
The largest producer is
still the United States.
No, China. Mm-hmm. The U.S. has a 7.5 million bale production, which is all for the export market primarily.
Would it be any different if the mills had stayed? Why have they all pretty much disappeared? First, the mills were in the north. Then they all moved to the south to be close to the source of production. And now they're all closed. Is it simply a matter that labor is cheaper in China?
Yes, it's what happens to all industry as it moves. And the cotton textile industry was the beginning of every single industrial revolution in every country. And it just moved from the UK to this country, to Japan, to China.
When did it stop being an issue in the lives of African Americans?
It began to be decoupled when African Americans moved north. There was, as said, a containment policy after the Civil War. And the black population of the North did not increase when you had 20 million white immigrants coming in. This all changed with World War I, when there was no white immigration, industry booms, and unemployment goes down. So the North sucked these African Americans into the city ghettos, and there were race riots that consumed. It finally decoupled with mechanization in the 1950s.
Although there were also an awful lot of black people going into the auto industry and other in the factories of the North, which in some cases, until unionization, wasn't all that different than being a sharecropper in the South.
No, and also the living situations.
Well, okay, you made the we've run out of time, unfortunately. Gene Dattel, D-A-T-T-E-L, his book, Cotton and Race in the Making of America, published by Ivan R.D.